Children of Dune by Frank Herbert. Copyright 1976 by Frank Herbert. This recording of the full-length reading of Children of Dune was published by arrangement with the Herbert Limited Partnership and was produced in 1998 by Books on Tape Incorporated. This book is read by Connor O'Brien. Children of Dune by Frank Herbert. This book is 408 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. Another masterpiece, the continuation of the classic Dune story. Dune, Dune Messiah, Children of Dune. The desert planet has begun to grow green and lush. The life-giving spice is abundant. The 9-year-old royal twins, possessed of their father's supernormal powers, are being groomed as messiahs. But there are those who think the Imperium does not need messiahs. Ranging from palace intrigue and desert chases to religious speculation and confrontations with supreme intelligence of the universe, there is something here for all science fiction fans. Publishers Weekly. Herbert's tale of power and politics and ecological salvation has been brought to a grand climax. Los Angeles Times. A portrayal of an alien society more complete and deeply detailed than any author in the field has ever managed. A story absorbing equally for its action and its philosophical vistas. Washington Post Book World. Children of Dune. The long wait is over. Dedication. For Bev, out of the wonderful commitment of our love, and to share her beauty and her wisdom, for she truly inspired this book. Muad'Dib's teachings have become the playground of scholastics, of the superstitious and the corrupt. He taught a balanced way of life, a philosophy with which a human can meet problems arising from an ever-changing universe. He said humankind is still evolving, in a process which will never end. He said this evolution moves on changing principles which are known only to eternity. How can corrupted reasoning play with such an essence? Words of the Mentat, Duncan, Idaho. A spot of light appeared on the deep red rug which covered the raw rock of the cave floor. The light glowed without apparent source, having its existence only on the red fabric surface woven of spice fiber. A questing circle about 2 centimeters in diameter, it moved erratically, now elongated, now an oval. Encountering the deep green side of a bed, it leaped upward, folded itself across the bed's surface. Beneath the green covering lay a child with rusty hair, face still round with baby fat, a generous mouth, a figure lacking the lean sparseness of Fremen tradition, but not as water-fat as an off-worlder. As the light passed across closed eyelids, the small figure stirred. The light winked out. Now there was only the sound of even breathing, and, faint behind it, a reassuring drip-drip-drip of water collecting in a catch-basin from the windstill far above the cave. Again the light appeared in the chamber, slightly larger, a few lumens brighter. This time there was a suggestion of source and movement to it. A hooded figure filled the arched doorway at the chamber's edge, and the light originated there. Once more the light flowed around the chamber, testing, questing. There was a sense of menace in it, a restless dissatisfaction. It avoided the sleeping child, paused on the gridded air inlet at an upper corner, probed a bulge in the green and gold wall hangings which softened the enclosing rock. Presently the light winked out. The hooded figure moved with a betraying swish of fabric, took up a station at one side of the arched doorway. Anyone aware of the routine here in Siege Tabor would have suspected at once that this must be Stilgar, Naib of the Siege, guardian of the orphaned twins who would one day take up the mantle of their father, Paul Muad'Dib. Stilgar often made night inspections of the twins' quarters, always going first to the chamber where Ghanima slept, and ending here in the adjoining room, where he could reassure himself that Leto was not threatened.
"I am an old fool," Stilgar thought.
He fingered the cold surface of the light projector before restoring it to the loop in his belt sash. The projector irritated him, even while he depended upon it. The thing was a subtle instrument of the Imperium, a device to detect the presence of large living bodies. It had shown only the sleeping children in the royal bedchambers. Stilgar knew his thoughts and emotions were like the light. He could not still a restless inner projection. Some greater power controlled that movement. It projected him into this moment where he sensed the accumulated peril. Here lay the magnet for dreams of grandeur throughout the known universe.
Here lay temporal riches, secular authority, and that most powerful of all mystic talismans, the divine authenticity of Muad'Dib's religious bequest. In these twins, Leto and his sister Ghanima, an awesome power focused. While they lived, Muad'Dib, though dead, lived in them. These were not merely 9-year-old children. They were a natural force, objects of veneration and fear. They were the children of Paul Atreides, who had become Muad'Dib, the Mahdi of all the Fremen. Muad'Dib had ignited an explosion of humanity. Fremen had spread from this planet in a jihad, carrying their fervor across the human universe in a wave of religious government whose scope and ubiquitous authority had left its mark on every planet.
Yet these children of Muad'Dib are flesh and blood, Stilgar thought. Two simple thrusts of my knife would still their hearts, and their water would return to the tribe.
His wayward mind fell into turmoil at such a thought.
To kill Muad'Dib's children!
But the years had made him wise in introspection. Stilgar knew the origin of such a terrible thought. It came from the left hand of the damned, not from the right hand of the blessed. The Ayat and Burhan of life held few mysteries for him. Once he'd been proud to think of himself as Fremen, to think of the desert as a friend, to name his planet Dune in his thoughts and not Arrakis, as it was marked on all of the imperial star charts.
How simple things were when our Messiah was only a dream, he thought. By finding our Mahdi, we loosed upon the universe countless messianic dreams. Every people subjugated by the jihad now dreams of a leader to come.
Stilgar glanced into the darkened bedchamber.
If my knife liberated all of those people, would they make a messiah of me?
Leto could be heard stirring restlessly in his bed. Stilgar sighed. He had never known the Atreides' grandfather whose name this child had taken, but many said the moral strength of Muad'Dib had come from that source. Would that terrifying quality of rightness skip a generation now? Stilgar found himself unable to answer this question. He thought,
Sich Tabor is mine. I rule here. I am a Naib of the Fremen. Without me, there would have been no Muad'Dib. These twins now, through Chani, their mother, and my kinswoman, my blood flows in their veins. I am there with Muad'Dib and Chani and all the others. What have we done to our universe?
Stilgar could not explain why such thoughts came to him in the night, and why they made him feel so guilty. He crouched within his hooded robe. Reality was not at all like the dream. The friendly desert, which once had spread from pole to pole, was reduced to half its former size. The mythic paradise of spreading greenery filled him with dismay. It was not like the dream. And as his planet changed, he knew he had changed. He had become a far more subtle person than the one-time siege chieftain. He was aware now of many things, of statecraft and profound consequences in the smallest decisions. Yet he felt this knowledge and subtlety as a thin veneer covering an iron core of simpler, more deterministic awareness. And that older core called out to him, pleaded with him for a return to cleaner values. The morning sounds of the siege began intruding upon his thoughts. People were beginning to move about in the cavern. He felt a breeze against his cheeks. People were going out through the door seals into the pre-dawn darkness. The breeze spoke of carelessness as it spoke of the time. Warren dwellers no longer maintained the tight water discipline of the old days. Why should they, when rain had been recorded on this planet, when clouds were seen, when 8 Fremen had been inundated and killed by a flash flood in a wadi? Until that event, the word drowned had not existed in the language of Dune. But this was no longer Dune. This was Arrakis, and it was the morning of an eventful day. He thought,
Jessica, mother of Muad'Dib and grandmother of these royal twins, returns to our planet today. Why does she end her self-imposed exile at this time? Why does she leave the softness and security of Caladan for the dangers of Arrakis?
And there were other worries. Would she sense Stilgar's doubts? She was a Bene Gesserit witch, graduate of the sisterhood's deepest training, and a reverend mother in her own right. Such females were acute, and they were dangerous. Would she order him to fall upon his own knife, as the Uma protector of Liet Kynes had been ordered?
Would I obey her? He wondered.
He could not answer that question, but now he thought about Liet Kynes, the planetologist who had first dreamed of transforming the planet-wide desert of Dune into the human-supportive green planet which it was becoming. Liet Kynes had been Chani's father.
Without him, there would have been no dream, no Chani, no royal twins. The workings of this fragile chain dismayed Stilgar.
How have we met in this place? He asked himself. How have we combined? For what purpose? Is it my duty to end it all, to shatter that great combination?
Stilgar admitted the terrible urging within him now. He could make that choice, denying love and family to do what a naive must do on occasion, make a deadly decision for the good of the tribe. By one view, such a murder represented ultimate betrayal and atrocity.
To kill mere children!
Yet they were not mere children. They had eaten melange, had shared in the siege orgy, had probed the desert for sand trout, and played the other games of Fremen children, and they sat in the royal council. Children of such tender years, yet wise enough to sit in the council. They might be children in flesh, but they were ancient in experience, born with a totality of genetic memory, a terrifying awareness which set their Aunt Alia and themselves apart from all other living humans. Many times and many nights had Stilgar found his mind circling this difference shared by the twins and their aunt. Many times had he been awakened from sleep by these torments, coming here to the twins' bedchambers with his dreams unfinished. Now his doubts came to focus. Failure to make a decision was in itself a decision. He knew this. These twins and their aunt had awakened in the womb, knowing there all of the memories passed on to them by their ancestors. Spice addiction had done this, spice addiction of the mothers, the Lady Jessica and Chani. The Lady Jessica had borne a son, Muad'Dib, before her addiction. Alia had come after the addiction. That was clear in retrospect. The countless generations of selective breeding directed by the Bene Gesserits had achieved Muad'Dib, but nowhere in the sisterhood's plans had they allowed for melange. Oh, they knew about this possibility, but they feared it and called it abomination. That was the most dismaying fact. Abomination. They must possess reasons for such a judgment. And if they said Alia was an abomination, then that must apply equally to the twins, because Chani, too, had been addicted, her body saturated with spice, and her genes had somehow complemented those of Muad'Dib. Stilgar's thoughts moved in ferment. There could be no doubt these twins went beyond their father. But in which direction? The boy spoke of an ability to be his father, and had proved it. Even as an infant, Leto had revealed memories which only Muad'Dib should have known. Were there other ancestors waiting in that vast spectrum of memories, ancestors whose beliefs and habits created unspeakable dangers for living humans? Abominations, the holy witches of the Bene Gesserit said. Yet the sisterhood coveted the genophase of these children. The witches wanted sperm and ovum without the disturbing flesh which carried them. Was that why the Lady Jessica returned at this time? She had broken with the sisterhood to support her ducal mate, but rumor said she had returned to the Bene Gesserit ways.
I could end all of these dreams, Stilgar thought. How simple it would be.
And yet again he wondered at himself that he could contemplate such a choice. Were Muad'Dib's twins responsible for the reality which obliterated the dreams of others? No. They were merely the lens through which light poured to reveal new shapes in the universe. In torment, his mind reverted to primary Fremen beliefs, and he thought,
God's command comes, so seek not to hasten it. God's it is to show the way, and some do swerve from it.
It was the religion of Muad'Dib which upset Stilgar most. Why did they make a god of Muad'Dib? Why deify a man known to be flesh? Muad'Dib's golden elixir of life had created a bureaucratic monster which sat astride human affairs. Government and religion united, and breaking a law became sin. A smell of blasphemy arose like smoke around any questioning of governmental edicts.